Porter, the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. And I wish I knew what day it was. No, Wednesday, April 6th. Oregon State Day. And I have my pin, I want everyone to know. Didn't quite go the tie with the bills. Welcome. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3082. And Patrick, do you want to tell us a little bit about my bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3082 provides a tax credit to farmers who add a non-toxic dye to ammonia, anhydrous ammonia, for the purposes of deterring theft from by producers of methamphetamine. It applies to tax credit tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2006, and it requires certification of brands of dye by the Department of State Police for eligibility. It would exempt farmers from liability for environmental contamination for the use of the dye. In your packets, members, are the Dash 1 amendments to the measure and a hand and gross bill, including the Dash 1 amendments. Those also apply a tax credit to legal distributors of anhydrous ammonia.
Thank you, Patrick. I just guess I want to start out with I've been serving about a year on the governor's methamphetamine task force, and we have a real problem in this state. And one of the problems is addressed in this bill, and that is the theft of agricultural producers of their anhydrous ammonia. And that's the reason for this bill. Our producers are facing tremendous pressures. They use this product for a fertilizer, and this is stolen in tanks and thermos bottles and whatever. It's very flammable, toxic, and we're trying to deter it. So we're trying to give them an incentive to use a non-toxic dye that will deter the meth cook. So it's part of the methamphetamine product where they actually use this as part of the they cook the meth with this anhydrous ammonia. I know we're going to hear more about it. Lieutenant Durbin and Sheriff Trumbull are going to give us an update on this. So I just wanted to say that I fully support this bill. I am asking for your support for this, and I know we have to have a public hearing on it and hear the issues and hopefully the questions from the committee. So I'll start with Lieutenant Durbin and Sheriff Trumbull, or do you want to come up together? Or and Sheriff Trumbull in a suit, that is amazing. And you knew I was going to say something.
I'd have been disappointed if you
did. I would. And for the record, you need to state your name and identify yourself. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Trumbull. I'm the sheriff of Umatilla County, which is in Pendleton. I'm also a member of the governor's task force on methamphetamine. And Representative Smith, we appreciate your input and your participation in that committee. In May of 2003, three young men and a young woman decided to steal some anhydrous ammonia from a farmer. They completely filled a 5-gallon propane tank with liquid anhydrous ammonia. Unfortunately, they apparently did not realize when heated, anhydrous ammonia turns to a gas. While en route to the Hermiston area in the heated car, the pressure in the propane tank increased to the point that the tank exploded. The tank was on the floor between the legs of one of the young men in the back seat. The young man is now blind, has lost 85% of his lung capacity, and has plastic plumbing. He requires 24-hour-a-day per-day care. The young lady sitting beside him in the back seat was killed. The other two men in the front seat were able to escape. However, they also suffered some medical problems because of their exposure to the anhydrous ammonia. The three survivors are being charged with manslaughter because their actions directly caused the death of the young woman. Umatilla County is going to be responsible for all the costs associated with the prosecution of the three survivors. The state of Oregon will be responsible for the incarceration costs of the three offenders, assuming that they are convicted and sentenced to the Department of Corrections. The state of Oregon is also on the hook to some degree for the medical costs associated with the 24-hour-per-day required care of the one offender. Social Security is paying survivor benefits. It has been estimated that when all the costs associated with the prosecution and incarceration of the offenders, survivor benefits and the lifetime medical care of the permanently disabled man are added up, between $1 and $2 million taxpayer dollars will be spent on this one incident. This is all over probably $5 worth of stolen anhydrous ammonia. The reported theft of anhydrous ammonia in Umatilla County have dropped. This is not because there are fewer thefts. It's because chemical suppliers and growers have come to accept the theft of anhydrous ammonia as just another expense they must bear. Growers understand there's a serious lack of a law enforcement presence in the rural areas. The lack of that presence makes it virtually impossible to either catch or prosecute a person involved in the theft of anhydrous. Growers used to lock up their tanks. They soon determined that it was cheaper to suffer a little loss of product than repair the damage to their equipment that occurs during a theft. A couple of years ago, I received a report that because of the security measures that had been taken by a grower, a theft of anhydrous had not occurred. However, because of either anger or frustration or both on the part of the offender, the tires of the chemical truck were slashed and the windows broken out. I would guess that $1,000 worth of damage was done over a meth user's inability to steal a few dollars worth of anhydrous ammonia. 2 weeks ago, a local chemical supplier had a storage lot broken into 3 times in a 5-day period. The offender had cut through his new security fence and had used his new security lighting so they could see to steal his anhydrous from his field applicators. By his account, he had invested approximately $20,000 in upgraded security for his company. He decided to take a proactive approach to the crime prevention. Obviously, his efforts were not enough to stop the theft. Another local agricultural chemical supplier thought he averaged about 3 or 4 thefts a week. They now use baling wire to repair the fence so it keeps further damage from occurring to the rest of the fence. Occasionally they find jackets and clothing that have been exposed to the spillage left behind at the scene. At this point, their biggest concern is that someone will try to steal anhydrous ammonia from their 33,000-gallon permanent tank or from a 30,000-gallon rail car that sits at their establishment. They are assuming that fear alone has kept this tragedy from happening. How long will it be before a person who is under the influence of meth creates a public safety and environmental nightmare? Last summer, the sheriff's office investigated the report of the theft of anhydrous. The suspects had cut a fence to gain entry to the storage lot where field applicators were stored. Anhydrous was taken from one of the applicators. The suspects then set up a portable meth lab just outside the fence and within sight of the applicator. Of course, when they left the area, they left a hazardous waste site that required cleanup. There is not a simple solution to address the meth epidemic. From a rural perspective, a passage of House Bill 3082 would not only directly address the issue of methamphetamine production, I believe it would also reduce the incidences of theft and criminal mischief to our local chemical companies and growers. I feel that even a more significant aspect of this bill will be to reduce the danger to the environment and the citizens of this state because of improper use and storage of anhydrous ammonia. $5 worth of anhydrous ammonia improperly contained and transported had cost the taxpayers of this state $1 million+. Now is not the time to become complacent. We must continue to be aggressive in our approach to addressing this epidemic called methamphetamine. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. Can I have any questions for the sheriff? Representative Oakley?
Thank you. If we add non-toxic dye to it, I mean that obviously marks the product. Does that prevent it from being used in meth production, or is it a tracking mechanism, or?
It's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lieutenant, but it's my understanding that it's a tracking mechanism. I think what would happen is that the word would pretty soon get out what chemical companies are using that dye, and most of their tanks are marked from which company, and I think that when they saw that a specific name of a company they know is to use dye, they would probably go somewhere else.
Does that answer your question? Now, any further questions, Lieutenant? Or do you have a
question? No.
Okay. You can stay there. Lieutenant Durbin, good morning.
Good morning. Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I am a lieutenant with Oregon State Police and currently serve as the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. And I won't go into all my testimony. You've heard a lot of what I would just reiterate what the sheriff had testified about. But this bill does address the primary reagent of anhydrous ammonia, which is used in the Birch reduction method, or, as you've probably heard, the Nazi method. And the reason they call it the Nazi method is because that it was actually developed in Germany during World War II to do a quick reaction on the battlefield and use it in sustaining the forces to be able to fight, and then we used it in some of our forces. The reagent is used anhydrous in farming, as you've already heard, and the reason it's so popular is that because it takes a very small amount of anhydrous, you use just a few chemicals, and then just in a few minutes you have methamphetamine, as opposed to on this side of the state in the valley and the coastal areas, they use the red phosphorus method, which is much more time consuming. They have to obtain flares, matches, those type of things to get their red phosphorus because it's so tightly controlled. They have to do a longer cook, and they tend not to get the purity level that they get with anhydrous ammonia. So anywhere that they have these tanks available to them, they will tend to migrate to that type of method because they can easily learn how to cook it, and they can use anhydrous very quickly to be able to do that. The cook or the smurfer, what they will do is that they will basically use any container to hold this anhydrous ammonia. They will use anything from a igloo cooler to a propane tank to an oxygen cylinder, whatever they can do to get to that tank and then dump that chemical into it. Within just a few minutes after that, they will already usually have the other ingredients, the lithium and the pseudoephedrine, the things that they need. They will pour the anhydrous into that mixture, and then a few minutes later, they will have basically methamphetamine. They just need to what we call salt it out with hydrochloric acid, a gas that they will use. This bill will accomplish many things. It will support this body's efforts in its effort to crush methamphetamine. As Representative Smith sits on the Governor's Meth Task Force, that was one of our charges from the Governor's office. And basically, this is another key in that effort. It will support law enforcement by placing a hurdle of those persons who wish to operate these toxic labs. It will support farmers and distributors being able to protect them. As you've heard, that there's repeated break-ins, repeated damage to their properties, repeated damage to these tanks, and it will protect the citizens, because we've already had several instances in Oregon where there's been gaseous cloud leaks that have drifted into areas that are populous, and it's just a matter of time before we do have a large disaster. This is also reflected in a chemical safety alert that was given out by the EPA, and I've included as an attachment in my testimony. And in this alert, they said that there's been leaks of more than 2,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia, that citizens have become overcome by these clouds, that police officers have been hospitalized, and there's been other incidents. And as the sheriff has testified, we had the incident with the group of individuals that was going down I-84. And in that instance, there was also, when this vehicle was in the ditch and there was this gaseous cloud, and what's unique about anhydrous ammonia, that when it's released into the atmosphere, it can expand up to 850 times. So, and then it becomes condensed in the moisture that's in the air, so it stays low to the ground and will travel great distances. This cloud stayed in a ditch. A truck driver stopped to render aid, and so did an off-duty sheriff's deputy. They attempted several times to go down this ditch, not knowing what they were dealing with, and they almost became overcome by the cloud. And in fact, the truck driver barely made it up the hill the third time that he went down, and he could have died there in that ditch very easily. The product reference in this bill was developed over 2 years by researchers at Illinois University. They attempted to find an additive that could be added to anhydrous tanks that would be a deterrent to meth cooks. It was a brainstorm of a farmer, and it was spurred on by the theft of anhydrous. The product was tested around the areas of Illinois, Kentucky, and Indiana, and within a week, the theft stopped. The product not only makes the meth harder to dry, but one of the unique characteristics of this product is that when this methamphetamine is finally converted, it's pink. And when the user attempts to inject it or snort it, it will actually cause that injection site to be pink or their nostrils to be pink for up to 72 hours. So then you'll have pink meth addicts running around. According to the makers of Glotel, about 96% of the respondents that are using this product said that they would use it again, and that they had a significant reduction in the theft of anhydrous ammonia from their tanks. So I'd like to address a few of the concerns that I've heard already about this bill, and one of those is that there's already a thin profit margin for the farming community, and that this would add a burden to them. Well, this bill is just voluntary. There is no mandate by those persons who would use anhydrous ammonia to apply this to their tanks. That farmers and their employees will be targeted as meth cooks. With the vast majority of rural communities are a very close-knit group, and law enforcement does readily identify persons within their community and knows their given profession. If law enforcement was to identify a person to have been stained by this additive, any suspicious conclusion would only be drawn by a combination of other factors to include their previous history, are they transient in the community, have they bought precursor substances, or any other information. To attempt any kind of investigation on a person simply based on staining of the person, I don't believe would happen. You have to develop other reasonable suspicion. And to take action against that person or that residence, you would have to have a level of probable cause that they, in fact, were involved in meth manufacturing to actually take any kind of action. What about other products? Well, in Section 5 of this bill, it authorizes the Oregon State Police, my office, the Chemical Diversion Unit, to approve other methods that would qualify for this program. In Iowa, there is a product that's being looked at that would be an additive. It would not be a dye marker. It would be an additive that would basically render anhydrous ammonia chemically useless against converting methamphetamine. So if that comes out and that's available, that's something that we could look at as well as adding to this bill. Glotel will hurt the soil or cause damage to the tanks. I just got off the phone this morning with Royster Clark, who is the distributor of Glotel, and this is an organic. It goes into the tank. It does not stain the field's tank. It does not cause any problems with crops, and it's basically neutral in the tanks. It is not a corrosive in the tanks, and they tested it over 2 years. So I really see this bill as one more step in our process to say Oregon is closed to these methamphetamine cooks. And we support this bill, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Lieutenant. I have a question. Do any other states have this kind of legislation?
Yes, there's other states that have proposed it, and there are other states that do have the legislation currently. Okay. I don't know if it's exactly as what we're talking about. There is legislation to support the Glotel additive, though.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have we found evidence that some of these meth cooks have, in fact, targeted tanker train loads of this stuff yet? And is there any indications they are?
No, when I talked to some ag suppliers first of the week, and they think that the only reason that they haven't, because that was my concern, he said the only reason they think that they haven't targeted it is because even meth heads are smart enough to know that if they'd have a massive release, it'd be all over for everybody. So he thinks it's just the fear of messing something up that has kept them from going after those big ones. And then, you know, there's smaller containers that are available too.
Thank you.
One more comment. In the back of this, what I have included is there's a Glotel requires that the person or the distributor that would use this product sign a license agreement. And in that, part of that agreement is that any tank that has this product would have this affixed to that tank. Mm-hmm. So as these people see this and they see this on their security fencing or see it on the tanks, it's not going to be very long at all because the word spreads very quickly amongst the meth community of what this will do and the word will get out. And I truly believe that the break-ins of these areas and these tanks will stop.
Thank you. Representative Wright.
Thank you. This committee is always very interesting. I learned so much here, but I'm a little, I guess, uncertain about the product. And is it something that is added at the point where it's not added at manufacture? Or could it be added at manufacture?
Chair Smith, Representative Beyer, I spoke with them this morning about this, and it probably could be added at manufacture. Typically where it's being added to right now is at the distributor level, that it's placed into the big bullet tank prior to the dumping off from the rail car. But it can be added even into the nurse tanks themselves. It just needs to be placed into the hose, and then the connection is made between the bullet tank to the nurse tank.
follow up?
Sure.
Thank you. And is this, how much would this add to the cost? Do you have any idea?
Chair Smith, Representative Beyer, it's right now it's about $9 per ton that it costs.
Follow up again.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The actual additive is $9 per ton, or it's
yes.
$9 to add it to a ton of...
Chair Smith, Representative Beyer, it's $9 per ton to that it costs to add it to.
Okay.
It's not $9 per ton of the glow tail itself.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Chair. Follow-up to that one. What does the ton of added harness cost, the product before the additive?
Chair Smith, Representative Roebling, you would probably better serve to ask one of the follow-ups that will be coming up. I'm not sure in Oregon what we're charging right now for a ton of anhydrous.
That was my question, too.
Right.
What it costs per...
And I'm not sure of that figure.
Well, we can find that out, that's for sure. Any other questions? Thank you very much. It's an important issue, and will you be available here after we have Terry Witt signed up, and then if there's any other
yes.
questions from the committee?
Yes.
Thank you.
Terry
Witt.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Terry Witt signed up to testify. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Since I don't see anyone from the Wheat Growers League here today, I'm representing not only Oregonians for Food and Shelter, but Far West Agribusiness Association and the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I'd like to preface my comments this morning to make it very clear that OFS, the board, and our members support all reasonable efforts, regulatory and otherwise, to curb the production and use of methamphetamine, and to put those who make, possess, distribute, sell, or expose others behind bars where they belong. This is, in fact, an insidious problem reaching epidemic proportions. We have been involved over the course of several legislative sessions making changes to existing law, dealing with precursor substances, increasing penalties. We also recommended and had language adopted that allowed enforcement officials to stop the use of a container for anhydrous ammonia that is not approved by the Department of Transportation. In the past, when dealing with precursors and methamphetamine, one of the problems was they had to show that these precursors were in possession with the intent to manufacture methamphetamine. And if somebody had stole a couple gallons of anhydrous ammonia and put it in a propane tank and had it in the trunk of their car, if there was no other clear evidence that they were in fact planning on manufacturing methamphetamine, I'm not sure why they would have anhydrous ammonia in their trunk, but nevertheless, to be able to prove that their intent was to manufacture meth was a very difficult charge. What we did was make it illegal to transport or store the material in an unapproved container, and that is automatically against the law, whether you're manufacturing methamphetamine or whether you just want to haul it around in your pickup truck for any other purpose. So that gave them a little additional tool, but again, it's just a small step in a long race. As you know, there are well over 40 bills in the legislature today dealing with methamphetamine in some way, shape, or form. We clearly support all of the activities to stop this use of anhydrous ammonia to produce methamphetamine, and we would like to make sure that all the members understand that the dealers, distributors, and growers want to be part of the solution rather than an unreasonable roadblock to some sort of fix. What I've put together here today is a list of comments, suggestions, and questions that have been compiled from both myself and Scott McKinney from Far West Fertilizer Association and Tammy Denny from the Oregon Wheat Growers League. They deal with the amended version of House Bill 3082, which contains the Dash 1 amendments. And again, the purpose of this is not to provide ammunition to defeat the bill, but to provide some thought-provoking questions that perhaps can be addressed so that we can have a better end product. Number one, the bill does provide voluntary incentives for the use of non-toxic dyes as an additive for deterring theft. Additives typically fall into three different categories. One is those that make a highly visible marking or staining agent. Two are those that render anhydrous ammonia unusable for producing methamphetamine. And the third type are those additives which severely interfere with the reaction and typically significantly reduce the yield that that results from the Nazi method of methamphetamine production. We would suggest, and I think as Lieutenant Durbin talked about the fact that there are other additives that are now being investigated and researched, we would recommend that Section 5 be expanded to specifically allow any anti-meth additive that is eligible for inclusion in the program as established or certified by the Department of State Police. The bill as it reads right now only allows non-toxic dyes, and we would hope that by next legislative session that we may well have some of these commercially available additives that render anhydrous ammonia useless for the production, which I think is even a better solution than just staining people pink. Number two, the Dash 1 amendments, change the definition of anhydrous ammonia to mean a caustic high nitrogen fertilizer used in crop production to which a non-toxic dye has been added. That creates some very convoluted wording within the document, because not all references in the statute, proposed statute, to anhydrous ammonia mean anhydrous ammonia with an additive already in it. So you wind up with, for example, on line 22, you wind up with a statement that basically says, it talks about the cost of adding a non-toxic dye to anhydrous ammonia to which non-toxic dye has already been added. It just doesn't make sense. So I think what would be a better solution would be to use a more generic definition of anhydrous ammonia, one that defines it as being an inorganic compound that does not contain water, consists of one atom of nitrogen and three atoms of hydrogen. That defines anhydrous ammonia as opposed to other forms of ammonia as well, which would be in some sort of water solution, such as the ammonia that you use to clean floors with, which is not anhydrous. Then if there's any specific references to crop protection or crop fertilization types of anhydrous ammonia, you could then further refer to that in the bill using the term anhydrous ammonia fertilizer used as in crop production or something to that effect. Three, we agree with the Dash 1 changes that extend the voluntary incentives for using these additives to qualified persons selling or distributing the anhydrous ammonia. As was noted by the previous testimony, that these bulk storage facilities, particularly in rural Oregon, are a prime target for these thefts. And we think that having those storage tanks treated is potentially a very good place to start. However, when you talk now about expanding from just the grower and the grower's tanks to the dealer distributors, I think you raise a whole series of additional questions that perhaps need to be addressed, and I'm not sure what they have been addressed. For example, if a distributor treats the anhydrous ammonia in his storage tank and receives a tax credit for it, will the farmer receive a tax credit for using it? If so, that would in essence be a double tax credit. If the farmer doesn't get credit for it, we may be disincentivizing the farmer to use treated anhydrous ammonia. If a dealer distributor in a particular rural area treats all of his storage facilities with a product like Glotel, then it really doesn't become a voluntary program per se for the farmer, because the people that supply the anhydrous ammonia in that area would already have it in, and I'm sure that dealers are not going to have two storage tanks, one tank with Glotel and one tank without, which would obviously defeat the purpose of even putting it in the first place. The other, I think the question was asked before by Representative Beyer about the cost. The current cost of a ton of anhydrous ammonia is about $550 per ton. If these costs are in fact passed on to the grower, it will have some significant impact on their fertilizer inputs. As you can see in my testimony, at a $9 per ton cost of treatment, if this was passed on to a grower who fertilizes with anhydrous ammonia at the rate of about 220 pounds per acre, which is not an excessive application, this would add about a dollar per acre to their application or fertilizer input costs, which is about a 1.6% increase. And again, while that may sound fairly minuscule, when you look at the very slim margins that many agricultural producers are operating on today, 1.6% increase in one of their major costs, which are agrochemicals, would indeed be could be significant. The other thing which I found very interesting in looking at the issue is that while we're specifically addressing some of the problems of theft of anhydrous ammonia from fertilizer storage of anhydrous ammonia, I did some investigation to find out how much anhydrous ammonia are we really dealing with in the state of Oregon. Based on the numbers from the Department of Agriculture, who charges a fertilizer tonnage tax, their numbers show that about 25,800 tons of anhydrous ammonia are used on an annual basis for fertilizer. Going to the state fire marshal's office, who collects data on hazardous substance through the Community Right to Know program, the total amount of anhydrous ammonia without counting farmer storage, which is not part of the Community Right to Know program, we bring in somewhere around 2 million tons of anhydrous ammonia per year into the state, or roughly 80 to 100 times the volume that's used for agricultural fertilizer. So it's a significant problem. There is a lot of anhydrous ammonia across the state, and a program that deals with some sort of tax credit or some sort of incentive, financial incentive, could be very, very costly if it's not very carefully crafted. I felt that the language in Section 6, for example, that is a good statement, which exempts from liability a grower for contamination if they use fertilizer with Glotel. But I think that the exemption needs to be narrowed down, that the exemption is for the potential contamination of the Glotel additive, and that we do not exempt farmers who fertilize for contamination with excessive nitrogen, for example, through over-fertilization. I think that would be the wrong way to go. I've included in your packet some additional information that comes from other states, such as Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, that are currently working on bills. I think it provides some interesting concepts that other states are looking at. Some are looking at establishing a grant fund as opposed to a tax credit. Some are looking at incentivizing increased security measures through the use of anhydrous ammonia safety and security practices, where if a grower or a dealer adopts these practices, then they are given exemption from liability, not only for injury or property damage created by the thieves trying to steal the product, but for other people that may be injured as a result of a release or some other problem created, I think, such as the situation that was discussed about the container that blew up in the vehicle. In many cases, the source of that anhydrous ammonia often gets drug into court and faces liability problems, even if there's an illegal act involved. So this is another concept that I think we can take a look at as a possibility. In other words, incentivizing additional security measures in and of itself is, I think, as the previous testimony stated, is probably not going to solve the problem, but I think it's a combined effort that can be another added notch in the belt, so to speak. And finally, although Lieutenant Durbin did comment about law enforcement harassment or what people might consider to be profiling people who have pink on them, it still remains a very serious concern by farmers, particularly those farmers that that, shall we say, are a little bit concerned about government's right to come and search and seize property. While I agree that these instances typically are far and few between, it doesn't take too many to sour the well, so to speak. So in closing, I would just say that we would be happy to work with sponsors and proponents of this bill to help make it a better bill, and we wish you the best.
Thank you. Representative Sumner?
Can you tell me, sir, just out of curiosity, thank you, Madam Chair, is this the same form of ammonia gas that's used in commercial refrigeration?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, yes, it is. Basically, it's the same material. And I think that's one of the major, what we call industrial or uses of ammonia is, anhydrous ammonia is for refrigeration. It is the primary replacement for Freon.
Yeah.
Sure.
Then, sir, possibly more people should be involved in this discussion of the commercial freezers and refrigeration that are. What kind of damage are they looking at in their compressors and the like? What is their liability, and when will they become a source for ammonia ripoffs?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, that's a very good question, and that's one that we have asked. And as Lieutenant Durbin did mention, we did receive some information from the manufacturer of Glotel talking about its corrosive nature. It does have some corrosive properties to certain metals, particularly things like titanium, which are used on tubes of refrigeration units. I think that is another area that we have to look at very, very carefully. And I would be surprised if, as we start to put the clamps on the availability of rural anhydrous ammonia, that I would be surprised if it didn't drive the meth folks to find other sources. I think typically the industrial uses, like in large refrigeration units, are a little more secure. They're typically inside buildings, so it's probably a little more difficult to get to than a remote tank out in rural Oregon. But these people are pretty ingenious in terms of obtaining the precursors they need to do their business. So I would say, yes, it will spread the search for anhydrous ammonia sources, and we definitely need to get food processors and those folks that use these materials involved to make sure that we're not causing any harm to their equipment or setting them up as targets.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I think the representative, though, raises the question about, okay, who gets this tax credit next? The farmers today and manufacturers tomorrow, all trying to figure out ways to deal with this chemical or gas or whatever it is. And then after that, what's the next chemical that we're trying to, you know, protect from that?
Was that a comment? Okay. I guess my only comment to that is we're trying to address a meth epidemic in this state, and I'm not sure we can worry about who gets the next tax credit. We have a real problem in Eastern Oregon, as the two
as the sheriff and Lieutenant Durbin testified to. And that is what we're trying to address. So I appreciate you raising these concerns and questions. I don't have any further questions. Do you have any comments?
Chair Smith, you know, I totally agree with you, and I was in contact with Al Goziak, who was with the Pendleton Grain Growers, and they are one of the dealer distributors that are having significant problems. They have locations around the state, and I think they were the one that was referred to as having 3 to 4 break-ins a week. And when you look at the damage that this is occurring, that is occurring as a result of these break-ins, it's understandable that we need, you know, they need to do something. I mean, that's a major financial burden on these distributors, and it does most likely, you know, lead to, well, we'll leave the gate unlocked, and you know, you might as well just create a filling station for these people, you know, similar to the way they have a filling station for propane at the gas station. I mean, from a financial perspective, you know, that makes a lot of sense to have them stop cutting locks and cutting hoses and breaking valves that are extremely expensive. In my previous life, I was on a hazardous material response team in the state of Michigan. I have seen firsthand what happens when you rupture an anhydrous ammonia tank car, and it is not pretty. It is a very, very toxic material. It causes severe lung burns, and I dread the day that some meth head tries to break into a tank car of anhydrous ammonia. I mean, it will create a significant problem.
Thank you. Representative Roebling.
How often do farmers in general treat a field with...
Chair Smith, Vice Chair Roebling, I think it really depends on the crop. It's not unusual for two applications of fertilizer. I think most do at least one, but it would depend on the type. When you go back into farming communities like in Iowa, where they use a lot of fertilizer in the corn areas, they will apply several times per year. I think wheat growers are another large user of anhydrous ammonia. So, but I think it really varies on the nutrient levels of your soil and the conditions, how much rainfall and whatnot. But I would say usually fertilize at least once, often twice. I don't think too many people would do it more than twice, but it could be 3 times. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that when they were trying to calculate that number of credit for applications per acre of $2.30, I think they made the assumption that would be a maximum of 3, based on a maximum of 3 applications per year, and that's, I think, how they arrived at that number, somewhere between 2 and 3, if you figure out that it's an additional cost of about $1 per acre.
Thank you. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm curious where all these pieces fit together, because I know that the Judiciary Committee has been working hard on meth issues and trying to put together something. So, and is this part of that, or is this, I mean, how do these pieces all fit together?
I guess to answer your question, this is part of that package that came out of the meth task force, and because it's dealing with agriculture, it's in this committee. It's probably the only one that is in another committee other than judiciary, so they are going to all fit together. This has a referral to ways or to revenue, so it's going to go down there because of the impacts, and I'm sure they'll all be put together at that point. I hope that answers your question. Any questions, Representative Witt?
Not yet, Chair.
A job elevation.
It's probably a work session question.
Okay.
I just need to ask you a question.
Okay.
How about?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Durbin and Sheriff Trumbull, would you like to add anything to this, or comment on anything that you just heard? And I appreciate Representative Beyer saying how much she
learned in this committee, she should be on the governor's meth task force. We've learned a tremendous amount. But please, if there's any comments you'd like to make on that.
Chairman Smith, the only thing that I would like to add is that this is about the theft of anhydrous, but I think as important, or maybe more so, is the collateral damage that is occurring during that theft. You have the criminal mischief, and when they're in these locations, they steal tools, and there's a lot of associated costs other than just the theft itself. And unfortunately, people that are in the meth culture don't always use good common sense and good judgment, and if they're under the influence of methamphetamine at all, or hyped to the point where they just got to do something quick as far as getting their fix, they get pretty bizarre in some of their motions. And so this is, I think, I really believe that the theft of the anhydrous is really the minor part of this whole problem. It's the collateral damage that goes with it, such as the tank that exploded, and you got millions of dollars associated costs there. We have people with prosecution costs, incarceration costs. There is so much indirect cost to the theft of a small amount of anhydrous that if we can just stop one theft, I have to wonder how much money can be saved by just the stopping the one theft. So I think we need to look at it from an aspect that's a lot larger than just the actual theft itself. It's all the indirect costs and the indirect actions that occur because of that.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, the only comments that I would have is that, in fact, what we heard is that they'll leave their gates unlocked, the distributors, because they've been hit so many times, is actually happening. And we have talked with distributors that say there's no point in trying to put up fencing and lighting and all those things around my tanks anymore, because I'm hit 2 to 3 times a week at these big bullet tanks that we're talking about. And these are 20,000-gallon tanks. And, in fact, one of these tanks did release in the sheriff's area a cloud down over the jail area because of being tapped into. And so, again, I just reiterate that this is a voluntary program. We're not mandating these people to put it into their tanks. I agree with some of the things that Mr. Witt had described that maybe we could fix in some of the wording and those things, and I think some of that clarification issues definitely should be done in there, and that this should not be passed on to the farmer if the distributor puts it into their tank and those type of things. So I think there does need to be some things that be cleaned up in it, but again, it's voluntary, and I believe that it will cause some of these people that right now, that the ease of accessibility of this chemical, and if we remember, they will take, and on this side of the mountains, they do red phosphorus process because it's a long ways for them to travel over into Eastern Oregon, and typically these cooks, what they're trained in and how to cook is what they will stick with. So if in the valley, if I'm taught how to cook with the red phosphorus method, that's the method I'm going to kind of stick with, and I'm going to take and collect flares, I'm going to collect matches and all those type of things to scrape off all the red phosphorus I need for the cook. But if I have a tank that's within 100 miles of me and I can tap into that tank and I can, in a few minutes, can have almost 90% pure methamphetamine, I'm going to go to that tank and I'm going to cook with that tank. So if it's accessible, if it's very easily accessible to them, they're going to go for it. In the aspect of refrigeration units and those type of things, I would tend to think that that's going to be very, very difficult because that is pressurized. And as soon as you tap into that system, it's going to release a cloud, and I don't know if you're going to get much of anything out of there. I'm going to check into that, and I'll check around to where the other anhydrous is going, but I think that's going to be a very difficult process for these people. Plus, typically, these are in buildings that are more secure and those type of things. So we're mainly talking about, and I really believe this is going to become centered on the distribution level, these big tanks that when this comes in and before it goes out to the farmers, it's already going to be added. And again, by them putting this sticker on their Glotel additive, it's not going to take very long before those thefts will stop. And the biggest concern I've heard from the distributors is the liability issue. They're saying that we need something in our tanks because the liability issue that they're concerned with a big release and causing a big disaster. So,
thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Thank you. Would you be willing to, if we had a meeting with Terry Witt and us, and me as sponsor of this bill and work out some of these issues. Would that be acceptable?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's what we'll do. Thank you for making the trip. Thank you very much. I think that's where we need to go, committee. I think they point out a very extreme problem that we are facing in this state, the liability, and I think this is something we can continue to work on. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3082. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
When you get together, the only thing I'd like to ask, in addition to discussing some of the points, is, and I haven't looked this up, but where it talks about lines 20 through 22, the three chapters with respect to taxes for the credit, just make sure that that captures all possibilities, because I'm not sure farmers organize differently, chapter, subchapter S, this.
Okay, good point.
Just to make sure that we've got it captured.
Yes.
And the other issue is that even in the county gross, we don't have the amount that they're going to give a distributor.
Right.
So we need to figure out those.
Well, I think that was figured out in revenue.
The revenue committee.
Oh, revenue will do that.
They would do that.
Assign that task.
Right.
Thanks.
Thank you. We'll move on. We'll do a public hearing on House Bill 2577. Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2577 identifies the Department of Agriculture as the primary state agency for assistance and coordination of noxious weed control programs and requires the department, in conjunction with the state weed board, to develop a plan for noxious weed control in the state to help secure federal and private funding for weed control projects, and directs the department to report back to the legislature on or before October 1, 2008, regarding their control and funding efforts. The bill has no revenue impact. Speaking with Legislative Fiscal Office this morning, they indicated that the bill will have no fiscal impact for this for the 2005-07 biennium, but they are still developing an understanding of whether it will have an impact for 2007-09. It's possible the Department of Agriculture might be able to address that while they're here.
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. Representative Jeff Krupp is here. And thank you for being so patient.
You're quite welcome, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. It's my pleasure to be before you this morning. House Bill 2577 is actually a companion bill to House Bill 3316, because they really both address the issues that have arisen over a period of years now, but have really come to fruition in the last few years regarding invasive weed species. And recognizing how serious this is, it's roughly $80 million a year loss plus was an old estimate of what invasive weed species cost natural resource individuals, such as myself. As you know, I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. It's of tremendous importance. And so, recognizing the need for that, House Speaker Mark Simmons in the 2001 session granted a group of us the opportunity to convene a task force to study invasive weed issues, which we did, albeit very late in 2002, because, as you remember, 2002 was a year of endless special sessions. And so we did manage to complete some work that was unsuccessful for a variety of reasons in the 2003 session. So we convened again in the interim, this last interim, as kind of an informal work group. And what we began to do is go back over our notes and all of the issues that we had explored as to how invasive weed species, noxious weeds, find their way to Oregon, and how would we deal with those things. And it is a massive minefield to try to pick your way through, because there are so many entry methods of how noxious weeds get here and how they create problems for us. And they're increasing, unfortunately, as our world becomes ever more mobile. Transportation is often the major source of allowing these types of noxious and invasive weeds here. And so we've tried to address that to some extent. It's very difficult when you're talking with the Port of Portland about container traffic, truck traffic, all of those entry points. As you know, ballast water issues for ships that navigate into Oregon, all of them create issues for us in this particular area. So we thought we would nibble around the edges first. And there's a reason why we brought these two bills before you, and I'll address House Bill 2577 first, is that the federal government also has been working on this issue, and there was an appropriation that wasn't funded by Congress last year to allow money to be disseminated through the USDA, I believe, to states for this particular problem. Because it is not only a problem in Oregon, but certainly in so many other states. And one of the things that came out of our work group is that that House Bill 2577 addresses is the issue of, okay, so we get some money from the federal government to deal with this, new money coming. How do we deal with it? Who has the authority over implementation of where that money goes, grants, those types of things? So even though the Department of Agriculture, and again this came out in our discussions, the Department of Agriculture has been the primary agency that's overseeing this effort. We have local weed control boards established there for the obvious reasons. But the department felt that we needed to express it a little more clearly in the statute exactly what the authority is of the agency to deal with this problem, especially since there's likely at some point going to be new money coming from the federal government that would be available. And that also helps us with the companion bill, House Bill 3316, which is basically sets up a tax credit for people who want to donate money for weed control efforts. Now, that may sound a little funny to you, but there are actually individuals, foundations, people who are, and you will hear from representatives of the Nature Conservancy. This is a big issue to the Nature Conservancy and so many other organizations, besides those of us who are involved in natural resource production of all types. This is an issue to them because they've made the investment in owning land, and they don't want it to become polluted with noxious or invasive weed species. So there are foundations, there are individuals who are out there who would, in fact, give money to these efforts. And that is, so if House Bill 3316 becomes law, then again we go right back to the issue of, all right, who's in charge of disseminating the money? And how do we do this? So House Bill 2577 really codifies and clarifies who's in charge and how we're going to make this happen. And that was the whole reason that we put this bill together. We're probably going to want to make one little change in consultation with ODA, so I'll have an amendment for you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee shortly. We don't want to say under Section 1, Line 13, we don't want to say the word develop, because frankly a lot of work's already been done on developing by the department the state weed board a plan. And really, we just want to codify that they should implement that plan and who has the authority to do that. So that really, in short summary, is precisely what we're trying to achieve here with this particular bill. And Madam Chair would be happy to entertain any questions.
Okay. How soon do you think you'd have that amendment ready?
I'm quite certain I could have it for you by next week, okay. Easily.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Webb? Representative Early.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yep, you're right. Huge problem.
Yeah.
And the only question I have is, how do we get the federal agencies? I mean, unfortunately, we have no power over them. I wish we did sometimes, but I mean, they're such a huge part of this equation. How do we get them involved, committed, you know, be an active partner in this whole thing?
Well, that's part of the vision of increasing the, I guess, through this legislation of stating publicly, firmly, who's in charge, the State Weed Board and the Department of Agriculture working together, then I think have more gravitas. I hate to use that word, but gravitas to the state or the federal agencies, from BLM, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, all of the agencies that at the federal level that have problems with noxious weeds. I think it says to them clearly that Oregon is raising this to a higher level of awareness now, and that especially if we pass the other legislation that talks about creating some kind of a fund where people can donate into, that we're saying, look, we want to be more proactive here. And that means, I think it sends a powerful signal to them that, hey, let's get together and start talking about these issues and start working on them. It was just, and this is a multifold issue, and it gets very complicated very quickly when you start talking about all of the transportation mechanisms. I was just chatting with a gentleman in the back of the room about you have individuals who have water rights that have typically irrigated their fields. They have at least the water rights in stream for other purposes. They've let the fields go. And now they're being taken over by weeds, which then spread to your neighbor's property. And I have had that happen to me on numerous occasions as a farmer. And so there are so many venues as to how this problem grows and just seems to expand year after year. That I think it's time that we went kind of to the next level, raised the awareness, started saying to our federal partners, hey, how can we work together here on BLM land, those kinds of issues, you know, from your neck of the woods, even here, Scotch Broom, the issues that has created, especially in eastern Oregon. It's phenomenal. And this is an opportunity, I think, for us, again, to say to our federal partners, hey, we need to start working on this at a greater level.
I'm just glad kudzu hasn't found its way out here yet.
It isn't far, Madam Chair and Representative Burley. It is not far from here.
Thank you.
Representative Pass, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Representative.
Thanks for doing this. I agree with it.
Where does ivy come into this? Is it considered a noxious weed? Is it a few years ago it was a quaint thing that Oregon did and grew. Now there's work patrols going into Forest Park to rip it out, and it's kind of taken over Forest Park.
Madam Chair and Representative Haas, that is a great question, and there's a gentleman sitting in the back of the room from Oregon State University who has is, I think, probably the preeminent scholar on this entire issue. Yes, I believe it is classified as such, and it is one of these problems that extends beyond just the rural areas. Mm-hmm. And you've just articulated that there are a number of these weed species that are extraordinarily difficult to kill once they become established, and kudzu is right almost at the top of that list. And he can articulate that better than I can, and or the Department of Agriculture is here also. There are a number of people that were individuals that have a real stake in this issue that were part of our task force and then our work group who, again, these bills were arrived by consensus, that these were the things we thought we could do, probably some other things that we should address in following sessions that involve more money, which is always an issue, but certainly so this particular session, and political things that need to be addressed to address even more of the major causes. But the individuals in the back of the room who have real expertise can really expand on. There are a lot of species that are on the list, and it is growing every day, and they can articulate that. And again, the problem is getting worse here in the numbers of species that we're finding here in the state now. And a lot of it, again, is part of our mobile society we live in. You know, you could ship just-in-time inventory from the Orient here, and who knows what you're getting in a package, and you cut the package loose, and something grows, and then it starts blowing, and there you go. And that happens. So as our society and our world commerce changes, this problem will only get worse.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Thank
Representative you. Sumner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thank you so much for this bill. This is a great bill, and I'm reminded of several years back, the infamous tansy ragwort, which killed hundreds of cattle, cost millions of dollars to eradicate, sort of eradicate, because I noticed on my drive last summer that I'm seeing tansy ragwort pop up again. We have to have some organized, centralized control and a plan and method to fight this stuff, because these things can absolutely destroy our entire ecology and cost farmers millions, billions of dollars. Congratulations. I think this is a great bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sumner. There have been developed over years some biological controls that have been effective at tansy ragwort. If you see those little caterpillars in the summer that look like this tie.
Yeah, I do see them. Very cinnabar.
The cinnabar moth is one of the great success stories of integrated pest management and alternative control. As a peppermint farmer for many years, one of my great pest weed species was groundsel, which is a cousin to tansy. And the cinnabar moth, once they became prevalent later in the season, would come in and literally just decimate the weed out of my field. And that then meant that I did not have to go buy an expensive chemical, put an expensive chemical along with a pre-harvest interval, and all of the liability issues that are becoming more and more important in the future. And I would hope that out of some of the money that we ultimately obtained from the federal government, and we can make investments in the future, House Bill 3316 helps provide money for research so that we can get to Oregon State University and have them develop further biological controls that are available for some of these invasive weed species and noxious weeds that are creating these problems for us. And again, I am pitching to you House Bill 3316 too. It offers an opportunity for the weed board to grant how that money is spent for what purposes, and research in new methods are one of them. And again, the cinnabar moth is a great success story, and I hope that we can build on that in the future.
Thank you, Representative Crow. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3316 as a matter of record. If you want to make a comment,
I do,
at the same
Madam Chair.
Time.
Thank you, and I do appreciate efficiency there. This bill establishes a noxious weed control fund. The state treasurer will administer that fund, or the money will go to him, and separate and distinct from the general fund. It consists of money that are deposited under various conditions. The State Department of Agriculture and the Weed Board can solicit and receive grants, can receive funds for this purpose. They also have the Department of Ag has the authority to expend the money in consultation with the State Weed Board for a number of reasons. Research development grants to weed control districts, which is the real intent here, is to get the money on the ground as quickly as we can. I need to make a number of amendments to this bill also.
I was afraid you might say.
Yeah. And so...
only on the work sessions.
If you have questions about elements of the bill, some of them are, I'm going to tell you in advance, are going to be modified. Again, the intent of this legislation, to establish it for the public record, is to provide an opportunity for people to give of their own money freely to create an opportunity for us to try to address this problem. It's just hard to get general fund money into ODA when we have food safety issues. It's our number one priority. That's an underfunded program. It's awfully hard to go and say we're going to put a lot of money in weed control these days. So, again, we're trying to find out-of-the-box and creative ideas. This, is, again, was an idea that came out of the work group that they thought was worthy of consideration. I would ask you to consider that. Right now, local under the ORS 570-560, it allows local counties and weed control districts to assess under the current statute. This puts some dollar figures in there. I'm not sure how all that plays out. One of the interesting questions that we might want to consider is, and I'm just throwing this out to you for consideration because I haven't formed an opinion of it, so I'm just going to give it to you as the legislature. What if the Department of Agriculture had, at the end of their budget cycle, a little bit of money left over for weeds in their weed fund? What would be the idea of allowing them to roll that money into this fund? I think we have to think about that. And just give it some thought. I haven't formed an opinion on it yet. It just came to me yesterday, and I know I'm kind of springing it on you. It's not part of the bill as it's written, but I'll do the committee's pleasure on that. I think it's an interesting idea that ought to be explored. Obviously, the state's not going to get a tax credit for rolling money in there, but obviously, if we put money in or they get federal money for weed control, and they have it in their budget, and for whatever reason it doesn't get expended, it goes back into the general fund, reverts back there. And would it be better for us to put that money into this purpose where it immediately can be granted and goes on the ground and gets used for that purpose? It seems to me that that's a fair idea to discuss. Maybe we ought to talk about it. So I will have amendments for this bill. Madam Chair, again, the intent is to provide an opportunity for people to give money if they want to help us get the ball rolling here.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Krepline?
Just a little quick one. In 3316, it acknowledges aquatic.
Yes.
It does not do that in the other one. And I assume that the plan there that they developed, that has been developed, would include solar. Well,
yes, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Roblin, that you're quite correct. And ODA, Department of Agriculture, will be able to address that for you specifically. There's been a lot of work done on this issue for a long time, actually. And that work continues on a regular basis. And we just kind of need to move to the next level now, I think. And this is sort of nudging us in that direction, is how I view these pieces of legislation.
Well, thank you, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Great bills. I think you raised some very good questions, and I know we have a real problem. So thank you. Dan Hilburn and Tim Butler are here from the ODA. The experts?
We'll do our best.
Great. And I have combined the two hearings, so you can talk about either one or do both.
Good idea. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm administrator of the plant division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me is Tim Butler, who's our noxious weed program supervisor. All through the testimony, he was making notes about ivy and kudzu and whatever. So we'll get you some answers to those questions. I wanted to start out, though, by thanking Representative Krupp for his work during the interim. He chaired many meetings of that interim work group to try to come up with some ways to really move this issue forward. And it's difficult. One of the big challenges is that a lot of it requires money, and there's just limited resources out there available to us. But these two bills are steps in the right direction. He talked about nibbling around the edges. I would say it's a little more than that. Solidifies or would clarify some authority for the department, and it would open up a way to make grants and gifts easy for the department to receive. So these are definitely things that we support and would hope that you would support. I'm going to stop right there and turn it over to the weed expert so we can get some of the weed questions answered and some of the specifics about these particular bills that we'd like to address.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is, again, is Tim Butler. I'm the manager of the Noxious Weed Control Program at the Department of Agriculture. And it's a pleasure to be here today. As we've already discussed, the noxious weed issue is a very important issue. It is something as far as making impacts to both our economy and agriculture economy and natural resources in general in the state is one of the primary threats that we have today. The issue has been termed a biological emergency, an explosion in slow motion, a biological wildfire. There's many different ways that people have characterized the issue, but it is a major issue. Representative Krupp had mentioned that in 2000 we did an economic assessment just looking at 21 of our now listed 105 state listed noxious weeds, and that equated to about $83 million a year, which is just a small piece of the reality of what weeds are making as far as impacts to our state currently. Nationally, weeds are making about a $25 billion a year impact on a national scale. So it's a very significant problem and something that we need to continue to work towards. And I think that the bills that we have here, that the task group worked on over the last few years and trying to come up with some ideas, that this is a step in the right direction to try to look at some innovative ways to get some additional funding and formally identify areas of responsibility to help address the issues. I might mention, and I'll try to, I was making some notes as Mr. Hilburn had said on some of the questions that came up, and I'll try to characterize some of those. First of all, I might mention the as far as the federal agencies' involvement and so forth. We have had good cooperation with the federal agencies, with primarily U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management over the last several years. They've continued to put resources and funding into weed management in the state, and have been very active in that regard as far as helping to support both our state program efforts and also county weed control programs around the state. So there's a lot of activity going on there, and the concern is if that funding level will continue into the future, because the federal budget, as you well know, is suffering as well, and there's some of the there's concerns that some of those dollars that have been going into weed control the last several years may start to dwindle some, which would be a real concern as far as maintaining viable programs. One of the important keys, I think, as far as from the federal agencies, is to maintain weed coordinators within the agencies, and to have state leads with both Forest Service and BLM in noxious weed management, and ensure that they can help to secure federal funding for their agencies and continue to support efforts on the ground as far as weed management in those different areas. So the federal agencies are doing a lot, and there's some good things happening there. They could do more, though, and we want to continue to push them in that direction. I made some notes that there was a reference to kudzu, as far as and kudzu is a noxious weed that is a major problem in the southeastern United States, where it infests about 7.5 million acres. Is extremely invasive. In 2001, I believe it did show up here in Oregon. It was the first site west of Texas. We identified that site, and then later that year, from all the media attention, we found another site that was reported in the Portland area. We were fortunate enough to be able to isolate that site, and it's been being treated the last few years, and we've gotten it are getting close to hopefully eradicating those sites. We have actually three sites now in Oregon that are under eradication, and they're small sites, and so it's I think it highlights the importance of having an active program at the statewide level, and also to encourage and have active programs at the county levels and weed partnerships and cooperative weed management areas and the different groups that are getting involved in weed management, to have all those entities available to help address the problem.
I think Representative Curley.
Thank you, Dr. Just out of curiosity, how are you eradicating the kudzu? What?
I want to know how it got here.
Well, I'm not going to tell you that coincidentally, it was the same year I traveled to Atlanta and back. That's another issue. Chemical application?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, yes, a chemical application is the most. There's a product called Transline that is pretty effective as far as controlling kudzu, and so we've been doing spot treatments with Transline, and it's showing some good results, and hopefully we have it the site controlled and under control. How it got here, we don't know. I mean, we wish we knew. And that's the concern, is if there's still other sites out there that we haven't found. We've been actively looking for it and doing survey and detection work, and that's important to do.
Thank you. Yes, and the reason I was particularly curious about how you're doing it is that I think that rapid and very effective application such as that is the only way we're going to control these things. And I just want to point out, and of course federal agencies aren't here to defend themselves, but that's been one of my biggest frustrations with the federal agencies. I cannot think of when the last time was they ever did a chemical application on federal lands, even though they know that these things are popping up. And if they hit them now, mm-hmm. It's like a wildfire. If you hit it now, you can contain it and control it. But if you wait and study it for 3 years, you've lost it. Just a comment.
The federal agencies are using more herbicides. It's true that the Forest Service for a number of years were not actively using herbicides as a tool in an integrated program. The Forest Service in particular is developing a new invasive plant environmental impact statement, and that a draft of that is out now, and that should be a final should be out sometime later this summer. But they have to go through a lot of environmental impact statements and so forth before they can act on these things. And that's exactly what we need to have, is to be able to particularly new invading weeds, if we can get in and treat those aggressively early on before it becomes a large scale problem. That's really what we all want to do.
Thank you. I think in a way we're losing the battle, because you say you work well with federal agencies, but in the Gorge, the National Scenic Area has a federal legislation involved in it, and we cannot touch those weeds alongside the roadway. I've worked on that issue for years and to no avail, and it is simply, it's Scotch broom, for example, is right along the railroad tracks all the way up the National Scenic Area.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There are roadblocks, and I think that we need to continue to try to work through those roadblocks so we can effectively address the problem. And it can be very frustrating at times to try to move forward with some of those issues. But one other issue that I had a note on that, if I may, that I might mention is tansy ragwort was mentioned, and that is something that in 1974 the legislature directed us to the department to move forward with a control program on tansy ragwort, and that has been a very effective program. We have been able to achieve a good control. That program is saving taxpayers $5 million a year on as far as the impacts of tansy ragwort, or preventing those potential impacts. And Representative Sumner mentioned that he was out and saw a lot of tansy coming back in a lot of areas. And that is one thing to note with that is that it's kind of a cyclic type of situation with the biocontrols. And what we see is resurgences of tansy in areas. And the biocontrol agents are there. There's the cinnabar that Representative Krupp mentioned, and there's also a tansy ragwort flea beetle that attacks the roots of the plant. And that is it kind of cycles in and out, and so you'll have a resurgence for 2 or 3 years, and then the beetles build back up and they will control it again. So you have kind of, but it maintains it at a much lower economic level than it was back in the mid 70s and early 80s, when it was causing about $4.2 million a year to, as far as dead animal losses, cattle and horses. So we have been successful with that effort.
Thank you. As one who lives on what is formerly known as Staggerweed Mountain, as a cattle producer, I face tremendous issues with what do you do with staggerweed? These are huge issues.
Yeah, it is.
there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I might mention, Representative Krupp mentioned that that we were instructed to develop a noxious weed strategic plan through House Bill 2118, and this was back in the 99 legislative session, and we did do that. I think as far as House Bill 2577, I would echo the points that Representative Krupp made as far as that we do have a plan in place currently as far as addressing noxious weed issues in the state, and it's still a viable plan, and we're continuing to work to implement objectives laid out in that plan as resources permit. And so I would, rather than developing another plan, I think to emphasize in the bill, if we could, to just implement the current plan and to continue to move towards the objectives that were laid out in that plan back in 2001 when it was presented to the Legislative Assembly.
Thanks. Representative Hines, have a question?
Yes, I just was the ivy guy and found any beetles who eat ivy.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, no, we haven't found any biocontrol agents that that work on ivy at this point, but I think to answer the question as far as if it is a listed noxious weed, it is on our state noxious weed list, and it is problematic. There's no doubt about it as far as...
If I could, Madam Chair, sure. What would, I mean, Forest Park, for those of you who don't know, is the largest urban park in the country. It's adjacent to Portland, and it's hundreds and hundreds of acres of mostly timber and thousands of trails. But it's being overrun by ivy. And like I said, there's these patrols every Saturday where people take truckloads out. Is there a more effective way to do that, or how would you do it if this was assigned to you?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, that's a difficult answer. I think that it's I think it depends on the site. I mean, to look at individual sites and look at a truly integrated approach on what options that you have in your toolbox and what you might be able to implement. I think that I know that there's been a lot of the manual control of hand pulling efforts, and that in a lot of cases is the only option that's available. In some cases, you know, the use of herbicides may be an option as well to keep it in check. So there's, you know, I think that we need to keep our options open and look at any given site and do a management plan on how to best deal with the situation.
Yeah, it is a tough one. I can imagine of all places in the world where you would not want to spray chemicals on a city park would probably be Portland, Oregon. On the other hand, the hand control, I mean, it's not
being effective. I think that we have to also look at the impacts that the weeds themselves are making to the environment as well, because that's obviously a major factor. Just to kind of summarize as far as the department's position on House Bill 2577, we obviously support the intent of the bill, which recognizes ODA as the lead agency in the state for noxious weed control. We believe that it's essential to have a statewide lead entity to assist in setting priorities for controlling noxious weeds and to make the best use of our limited resources, to make sure that we're getting resources to the areas where we can make the biggest difference. And I think that one of the things that has that's been a real positive thing is there's been a variety of different groups throughout the state that have been getting more active in weed management, either watershed councils or there's been cooperative weed management area groups. There's Northwest Oregon Weed Partnership group that has formed. So there's a lot of interest, a lot of people that want to do things, but there's a limited pot of resources there to put towards the problem, and I think it's important to try to direct those limited resources to the areas that we can do the most good. And so that is kind of the intent, I think, one of the intents with this bill. So,
just a quick one, a little bit on my sarcasm. And it has to do, if say we're really successful in this program and we end up close to eradicating, well, then we have to have a federal plan to manage them afterwards.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Roblin, that's a good question. I don't have an answer for that. But
I would add there that these weeds that we're talking about are not native plants. So even if we were successful, they would never become threatened and endangered because they don't belong here. They're all exotic.
Sure.
Was that recorded?
No.
Yes. Thank you very much. I don't think there was any other questions for you. Thank you very much.
I might just one quick comment on House Bill 3316. Again, we support the intent of that bill as well, as far as looking at additional funding resources through that bill. So
thank you.
Thank
you very much.
Okay.
Justin Martin. Thank you for being so patient. Looks like a man on a mission. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. We are here in support of both House Bill 2577 and House Bill 3316. Oregon's efforts to control noxious weeds is a direct investment in state agriculture and forest industries that will show tangible benefits resulting from increased productivity. We're here in support of Representative Krupp and have been at the table through the task force over the years working on these. We believe that three things are critical to the management of noxious weeds and the controlling of noxious weeds. One, monitoring of new threats. Two, control of existing weeds. And three, public education and outreach. Significant steps were taken during the 99 legislative session through the Oregon Noxious Weed Strategic Plan, but work does remain to be done to fulfill the potential of Oregon's efforts. Finally, the Nature Conservancy has created a specific invasive species initiative that, again, kind of focuses on those three areas. We look at prevention, we look at early detection and rapid response, restoration, research, and then finally outreach, more of the public awareness. So with that, again, the Nature Conservancy of Oregon is here today to support both House Bill 2577 and House Bill 3316. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Suggestion? Thank you very much. Glenn Stumbring. And if you testify too long, we won't get to your other bill.
Be brief. Very brief.
Just kidding.
Glenn Stumbring with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. We're here in support of both bills, but I want to make a couple points. First of all, I want to make sure that when we talk about noxious weeds, that does not mean invasive species. There is beginning to get a blurred line there that when we say noxious weeds, it means invasive species, and we're not. We want to make sure that that's not the case. I actually appreciated very much Representative Haas's frustration with ivy in Portland Park, because if you multiply that by hundreds of thousands of acres, then you begin to see what's happening in the rest of Oregon and the frustration as cattle producers and farmers that we have in the rest of the state. While it may be an inconvenience or a nuisance in Portland Park, it's a killer in rural Oregon. I won't spend a lot of time other than, as you had seen in some of the earlier informational meetings on the noxious weeds, that it is a cancer. It's just like a cancer on the environment, the economy, and production of agriculture. So we need all the help we can get. These bills may not set the world on fire as far as a big change. I would hope that we wouldn't spend a lot of money creating a new plan, and as I heard the previous testifier speak, that we have a plan, but to get results. And I think we have to be super aggressive in seeking funds, and we don't want to mess up those with any kind of new plan. There are areas in the state where the weed boards are working. There are success stories out there, and I'd like to see them investigate those and try to replicate the success stories of where it works rather than something always brand new. And, you know, I hope someday that maybe through the legislature, aggressiveness from you, that that you can put some heat on the federal government. The borders of this state, the boundaries of this state, make the state, the sovereign state. And I think sometimes you have to reach out and say, wait a minute, federal government, you don't always have the supreme position in some of these issues when it talks about public health, especially public health. And this is one of those areas. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. No. Thank you very much. It's everyone I had signed up to testify. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2577 and House Bill 3316. In committee, I'm going to wait until Representative Krupp contacts us with the amendments that he has before we do a work session on these bills. And the only other agenda item we have is a work session on House Bill 2656. I'll open the work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that we adopt Amendment 4 to House Bill 2656.
Representative Boakes has moved the Dash 4 amendment.
Dash 4 amendment, ma'am.
To House Bill 2656. Do I have any objection? Any discussion? So moved. Representative Boakes. Oh. Gavel the adoption of amendments. Okay.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2656, as adopted with the amendment, be referred to the House Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Boakes. I have House Bill 2656, as amended, moved to the Ways and Means Committee for prior reference. Do I have any discussion? Do I have any objections? So moved. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2656. And committee, if anybody needs information, we're not going to have a meeting on Friday, the 8th, but we are going to be in Sisters at 1 o'clock on Monday. And if anybody needs a ride or information to contact Patrick, to
this
let him know.
This is just a day trip, right, Patrick?
This is just, oh, I hope so.
Yeah, you can go over.
What Sisters?
Yeah, you can go over and back.
Can I bring them?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And Patrick's going to take care of getting you excused from floor sessions.
Oh, okay, thanks.
So that will be taken care of. So right. If you have any questions, contact him. And I'll see you at 1 o'clock in Sisters on Monday. We are adjourned.